From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. Hey everyone, the summer is racing away. And today we are going to be talking about snow. Our Lady of the Snows will be connecting with Father David Uribe from the Shrine of Our Lady of the Snows from Belleville, Illinois. And later in the show, we'll be talking with Father Donald Wolfe from the Shrine of Blessed Stanley Rother in lieu of his feast day, which is coming right up. Check out my series on EWTN that airs every week. That's They Might Be Saints. And one of the most popular episodes is one about Father Michael McGivney. Of course, you know him as the founder of the Knights of Columbus. And I examine the canonization cause for Father Michael McGivney and look at the founding of the Knights of Columbus and his beatification, which was in 2020 after the miraculous cure of a boy. And that cure was attributed to him and validated by Rome. So check that one out Sunday, August 3rd at 1:30 p.m. Central Time. That's They Might Be Saints with Father Michael McGivney. And my other program, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, where I travel all around the world to the famous places of miracles, a show coming right up at 5 p.m. on July 26th, relates to Naples. And I travel to Naples to probe the mystery behind St. Januarius, San Gennaro, as they know him in Italy. And on his feast day, the dried blood of this 3rd century bishop martyr is said to liquefy in a sign that no harm will befall the people of Naples. So that's a really interesting one. Check that one out Saturday, July 26th at 5 p.m. Central Time. Later in the show, we're going to be looking at the Might Be Saint of the Day. For today, we've got Blessed Giuseppina Maria de Micheli from Italy. And of course, she has that connection to the Holy Face devotion. We'll be talking about that in a little bit. And Our Lady of the Beech Tree from Castelluccio in Italy, July 26th. And the question of the week, when did the church begin requiring a miracle for some martyrs to be canonized? It wasn't always that way. And the miracle of the day for July 26th in the year 1973, we have one of the miraculous events related to Our Lady of Akita in Japan. We'll talk about that later in the show. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week where we talk about the miracles happening all around the world and those things that relate to miracles. And this is one of the first comments we see from our new Pope, Pope Leo, related to an apparition. And of course, throughout Christian history, we have so many apparitions of the Virgin Mary. If you go to my website, miraclehunter.com, you might find as many as 2,500 cataloged there. But there have been miracles and apparitions related to saints throughout history. Padre Pio famously, but actually, we have a big anniversary, the 400th anniversary of the apparitions of St. Anne in Auray in France. And so we have a letter that was issued by the Pope, Pope Leo, who wanted to recognize this event. They're having a big celebration, as they always do, on the round-numbered years, like 100, 200, 300, 400, and beyond. They always do big celebrations at the places of apparitions for those. And so I'm just going to read the letter of Pope Leo for this occasion. He says, "To our venerable brother," and this is delivered by Robert Cardinal Serra, "to the Prefect Emeritus of the Congregation for the Divine Worship and Discipline of the Sacraments, the Most High deigns to reveal the ineffable mysteries of the Kingdom of God, especially to little children. And for this reason, by the grace of God, St. Anne, the mother of the Most Sweet Blessed Virgin Mary, miraculously appeared to the farmer Ivo Nikolacic, and that so that the faith of the Eremonica people might be rekindled in a spiritual flame. A small chapel was built due to the frequent gathering of devotees, became a notable sanctuary dedicated to St. Anne d'Auray, and over time a much desired place for countless pilgrims. And finally, on a sunny day in September 1996, our predecessor St. John Paul II also arrived there happily to nourish and enliven the faith, hope, and charity of his families. And therefore, taking this auspicious occasion of the 400th anniversary of the apparitions of St. Anne in the town of St. Anne d'Auray, Next July, the Venerable Brother Carmen Raymond Cantini, the Bishop of Venice, most humanely requested that Pope Francis, and now bestowed to me, to designate some outstanding which would preside over the celebrations in commemoration of St. Anne in the name of the Supreme Pontiff and would pronounce words of spiritual encouragement. In wishing to give this pious request and confirming the resignation expressed by our predecessor, Pope Francis, of happy memory, we have recourse to you, our Venerable Brother, who, endowed with piety and learning, is a diligent, eminent worker in the vineyard of the Lord. And so it goes on to celebrate this big event from the Vatican on this 25th day of June in the Holy Year 2025, in the first year of our pontificate, and that's signed by Pope Leo the 14th. And I've linked to this article on the Facebook page of the Miracle Hunter. You can read the whole thing for yourselves, but this is basically just a big celebration or honoring of this event, this apparition that was reported 400 years ago of the mother of the Mother of God, and that is St. Anne at Auray in France. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize to an emailer who writes in the fastest with the correct answer. And so for today's last week's question, who was the most recent martyr beatified or canonized from the United States? And a lot of people wrote in saying Blessed Stanley Rother, whom we'll be talking about on today's program. And he was declared by Pope Francis on December 1st, 2016, and beatified in 2017 in Oklahoma City. But that's not the answer. There's been a more recent martyr beatified, and that is Blessed James Miller or Brother Santiago, as he was known. He was beatified on December 7th, 2019, in Huehuetenango in Guatemala, with a ceremony presided over by Cardinal Jose Luis Lacunza Mestra Juan. And that is, he is the most recent martyr from the United States. Again, that's Brother James Miller, or Brother Santiago. And of course, he's a blessed. With one miracle, he'll be known as a saint. And so for today's date, the question is, we're talking today about Our Lady of the Snows, the shrine in Belleville, Illinois. The question is, where is the main shrine, the international shrine, the first shrine in the world related to Our Lady of the Snows? If you think you know that answer and want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com, and answers and winners will be posted on the show page of miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Father Donald Wolfe from the Shrine of Blessed Stanley Rother in lieu of his feast day, which is coming right up. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. We talk a lot about future saints on this program, American saints, and people tune into the program They Might Be Saints, which airs on Fridays at 4 p.m. Central Time. And we have featured on our show venerables and blesseds before they have all their miracles and they're declared a saint. And many people don't know this, but in the United States, if you are declared, and in the world, if you are declared blessed, you can have a church or a shrine dedicated to your honor, to your name. And we have just a handful of blesseds. Father Michael McGivney, perhaps, is the most recent one. You might know Solanus Casey or Blessed Francis Xavier Silos. You might also know Blessed Miriam Teresa Demjanovic out of New Jersey. But we have two martyrs here in the United States, one of whom is Blessed Stanley Rother. And the exciting news that's coming out now is that there is the dedication, the launch of a brand new shrine dedicated to his honor. We're so excited today to welcome back to the program to talk about this great martyr. We're talking today with Father Donald Wolfe. Welcome back to the program, Father Donald.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So this is an exciting event that's coming up on February 17th. It is the official dedication date of the new shrine dedicated to Blessed Stanley Rother. Tell us a little bit about what this event is all about.
Well, it is the opportunity to inaugurate this shrine which has at its heart, you know, the focus of what Stan's life was, which was to invite people into the fullness of you know, God's goodness and God's grace. So the shrine is to help us see that through the window of his life and his example and his martyrdom, his experience. But, you know, the emphasis in the shrine is on, you know, the goodness of God and the opportunity to experience that goodness in our lives, the way Stan, in his example and in the work that he did, emphasized that in the missionary work that he did. So it's the opportunity to celebrate his life, and by looking at that, to see what the true focus. So if you can imagine taking a look through the slats of a window, you look through the window and then you see what's outside. Well, you notice the window, but what you're really focused on is that vision outside, and that's what the focus of the shrine is, on the goodness of God and the presence of God at work in our lives.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Father Donald Wolfe about Blessed Stanley Rother and the new shrine that's being dedicated on February 17th. I've traveled around the United States to most of these places that honor blesseds before they become saints. And Francis Xavier Silos in New Orleans has an impressive shrine down there. But I've been on the website for this brand new Rother shrine, and it's quite impressive. Talk to us a little bit about the process from the beginning when you got the green light to go ahead and build this shrine and the process of the design and construction.
Well, it was the intent of the diocese, of course, to be able to focus on Stan and Stan's example. And it was the intent of the Archbishop Coakley, that we have a shrine worthy of his example. And so the diocese underwent a large capital campaign process to raise the money for the shrine. And then we put together a series of committees, of course, to come up with a design. The design is actually based on the Spanish Baroque style that was part of the sort of missionary effort throughout Central America, all through the time that the evangelization took place there. And so that's the basic architectural design. But we wanted a place that would be adequate for the work of the shrine as this place where we gather people to honor Father Rother and his example, as well as to be a place where we could serve the needs of the growing Hispanic community in Oklahoma City. So it has both of those functions. So it is a large place, but it also will be the seat of the largest active parish in the state.
Amazing. Yeah. We're talking today with Father Donald Wolfe, the rector of the shrine to be newly dedicated. That is the Blessed Stanley Rother Shrine. And it's absolutely amazing. I've really enjoyed following the process along the way. And, of course, Blessed Stanley Rother is a martyr. And I think that some of the architecture perhaps is a pays some homage to the area in which he served in his missionary work. Talk to us a little bit about the life of Stanley Rother and how it culminated in his martyrdom.
In 1968, Stan volunteered to become a part of the missionary effort that was directed toward Guatemala here from Oklahoma. He became a part of the mission team that had been established there beginning in 1963. And when he got there, he joined several priests and several lay missionaries who were at work in the Mayan highlands south and west of Guatemala City around Lake Atitlan, the largest of the volcanic lakes in Central America. An absolutely stunningly beautiful site. But the place that he went to, Santiago, St. James, was a town that had been without a pastor for 100 years because of its poverty and its isolation. The emphasis there was on, you know, fundamental evangelization. So he joined the team that was already in place, and through the course of time, as priests kind of cycled out and left the mission, eventually there in the early 1970s, he was left by himself. Now, in the course of that time, from 68 into the early 1970s, he had learned the local Mayan language, which is spoken by only those people in that village and nowhere else in the world. Hmm. He had learned the language, had become the pastor, and was, you know, working to serve the needs of his mission area. And like so many of the stories that I used to read when I was a child about the missionaries in places like the Philippines or in China, you know, his parish encompassed almost 40,000 people. So he was the sole pastor of a parish of 40,000 people. So during that time, as the mission work was continuing, also the work of the unrest in Central America was taking place in places like Guatemala and in Salvador, in Nicaragua. It was highlighted by the Sandinista takeover in Nicaragua that really heightened the tension and the uncertainty all through Central America, and with the with the U.S. government all through the 1970s till 1979, the army came to occupy Santiago and to disrupt what they thought was the kind of growing insurgency in that area of Guatemala. And so when the army came to occupy the village, they began their anti-insurgency program, which included kidnapping, torture, and murder. And Stan was faced with the prospect of how to meet the needs of his people, how to keep them together in this time of difficulty and persecution, and how to respond to the presence of the army there, where you know their work is disrupting everything and everyone. He also had to deal with the very difficult intricacy of the government that supported the other religion missionaries there as well, and you know, to try to keep the church together as it was being pulled apart by different groups who came down to say, this is the real church, and you know, you're all with the bad guys and those kinds of things. So it was a really, really intricate challenge. And Stan was a hands-on kind of pastor. So he didn't just speak to the people. He was instrumental in working, you know, to improve their welfare. He helped to sustain the radio station that was there. He helped to sustain, you know, the good farming practices there. He put together the co-op that they had so that the locals could, you know, sell their products at better prices, all those kinds of things, as well as to revamp the religious education program, to renew the liturgy there, to strengthen the catechetics, and all the work that, you know, a caring pastor needs to do. In addition to that, especially during the time of the persecution, he was instrumental in helping to confront the local authorities when people disappeared. There were more than 100 people who were taken during that time, and oftentimes Stan would go search for the bodies because people would simply disappear and never reappear. And sometimes they would find bodies on the edge of the road or you know, in dumps or pits and things like that. The families whose loved ones had been taken and then tortured and murdered didn't want to come and claim the bodies because they didn't want to be identified, and so Stan would be the one who would go to pick the bodies up. So that kind of hands-on, immediate presence, which is put him in conflict with the people who wanted to, with the army and the others who wanted to control what was going on in Santiago, which that tension ultimately led to his martyrdom in July of 1981.
Absolutely incredible. What a story. I think people are going to get to know his story even further with the dedication of the brand new shrine coming up this week. It's an exciting story that people need to know. We're talking today with Father Donald Wolf, the rector of the newly dedicated, as of February 17th, Blessed Stanley Rother Shrine. And when we talk about martyrdom, we talk about the idea of somebody dying in odium fidei, out of hatred for the faith. And of course, there's sort of a mix of political and religious tensions going on in this location. How does when they examine whether this martyrdom is politically motivated or religiously motivated, how do they come to that conclusion?
Well, looking at the sum of Stan's life, he was noted all through Guatemala, and this is in letters sent home by other missionaries and by the testimony of other missionaries, the people that I've talked to in completely kind of random opportunities. Stan was noted as being the apolitical guy, you know, when the American missionaries would get together and talk about what's going on in Guatemala and what needs to happen, he's the guy who wouldn't get involved in the big discussions about whether it was better that the government change, or you know, if it would be better if the, you know, whether the American government supported this particular president or not, or whatever. Stan was the guy who stood apart from those discussions. He was the guy who continually maintained that it makes sense that change is necessary, but violence will only result in more violence. And so when it came time to kind of determine, is this a political murder? Is this a religious murder? Of all of the missionaries in Guatemala, Stan was the one most noted for being the least political.
Uh-huh, interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I talked to a priest who came here actually for actually he was another diocese. He was giving a retreat, and he had been in Guatemala at the same time as Stan. We were talking, and he had no idea I had any connection to Oklahoma. And he talked about that and the irony involved, that of all of the people who said all the outrageous and all the outrageously political things that were so common among the folks at that time, that Stan was this guy who was eventually murdered, but he was not the political voice at all. So
amazing.
Really a fascinating kind of thing. And again, once you get inside of what's going on, I always have tried to imagine what the people involved in this decision to go ahead and kill this American priest in this little town, what were they thinking? And I don't know what they were thinking as far as what's political and what's religious. Because inside of the imagination of a caring pastor, in any circumstance, you're always asking about the welfare of the people. You're always trying to connect what the interior life and the exterior life is. You're always trying to understand and then trying to affect that what goes on in a person's soul is by definition connected to what goes on in their, you know, in the rest of their life. And so Stan's approach was always that it was certainly impossible to distance yourself for anybody to distance himself from what was going on, you know, in the larger world, where, you know, his principal catechist was kidnapped and murdered off the front porch of the rectory by men in jeeps and uniforms. And so, you know, why would they kidnap the catechist? You know, what was going on in their imagination? The guy who's teaching First Communion, and he's being hauled away and tortured to death. You know, Stan saw that happen. So in his imagination, in his experience, all of this is one experience. Your faithfulness to the people that you serve is the measure of how much you give yourself to their needs. And that was certainly one of the measures of his life.
What an incredible life. And as we wrap up the interview today, we're talking, of course, about Blessed Stanley Rother and the brand new shrine that's being dedicated on February 17th. For people who want to visit this shrine, perhaps even attend the dedication, where should they go to learn more about the big news of this new shrine?
The best site is archokc.org. That's Archdiocese of Oklahoma City. So archokc.org.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Father Donald Wolf, the rector of the Blessed Stanley Rother Shrine, being dedicated on February 17th. I encourage people to learn more about the life of this incredible man, this martyr, Blessed Stanley Rother, and visit that brand new shrine in Oklahoma City. Thanks so much, Father Donald, for joining us on today's program.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
God bless. That was Father Donald Wolf, the rector of the Blessed Stanley Rother Shrine, being dedicated on February 17th. Always a big deal when new shrines are being built, and we have so very few blesseds and so very few martyrs here in the United States. This is truly a special event that's coming up on February 17th. I encourage you to learn more about the life of the incredible martyr, Blessed Stanley Rother. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN, Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And this is a really good question that I got this week, but I want to just emphasize how much I enjoy getting people's questions. People write in with some interesting thoughts that they're thinking about related to miracles. And I love meeting people when I give presentations around the country. I speak at different parishes or shrines or conferences, always talking about miracles, of course. And so that's always a big thing. And so I always talk about Eucharistic miracles or Marian apparitions or how the church judges the supernatural. Those are some of my favorite topics to talk about. But I always open it up for questions afterwards, and I love to hear what people are thinking about. And there's always a lot of good ones that we get. So if people want to have me at their parish or event, you can send me an email to go to the contact page on miraclehunter.com or send me a message through that in order to invite me to your parish sometime soon. And so the question for this week, as I mentioned, is a good one, and I think most Catholics don't know this answer. When did the church begin requiring a miracle for some martyrs to be canonized? Thank you, Jim. And you may have noticed in the history of the church, we have so many saints, as many as 10,000 canonized saints, and some are confessors and some are martyrs. And so when we talk about the martyrs, those are those people who died in odium fidei, or out of hatred for the faith. And so traditionally, throughout the centuries, when somebody died as a martyr, they were elevated immediately to sainthood. They were made saints. And of course, we might see big groups of martyrs, the martyrs of Oronto or other ones, the North American martyrs, big groups of people who were killed. And in those cases, we might say, well, it's a big group. How do you know who, you don't need a miracle, because how do you know who you're praying to at that point in those big groups? But it turns out that in the old days, you didn't need a miracle. You just needed this recognition of martyrdom in order to be recognized as a saint by the church. But now, as of 1983, the norms instituted by St. Pope John Paul II, he set it up so that and along with other changes, including requiring less miracles in the confessor canonization causes, he said that for martyrs, one miracle is needed. So you get to the point of blessed. You get declared blessed once it's been established, your martyrdom. And beyond that, though, to jump from blessed to saint, you do need a miracle. So that's an interesting thing. So it's a great question, Jim. Thanks for your question. So prior to 1983, no miracles were needed for martyrs. After 1983, you need one, which is half the total needed by the more typical saint causes. So thanks so much for your question, Jim. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com, and maybe I'll be reading your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. We do this every week where we talk about miracles happening all around the world, and especially related to the Virgin Mary. And believe it or not, for each and every day of the calendar year, there's a different Marian miracle that lines up exactly to the day's date from somewhere around the world. We think of Fatima May 13th, or Guadalupe December 12th, or Lourdes February 11th, but believe it or not, there's a different Marian miracle for each and every day of the calendar year. And so for today's day, we've got Our Lady of the Beech Tree from Castelluccio in Italy. And that's today's commemoration on July 26th. And the story goes that near Castelluccio, a young shepherd received a vision of the Virgin Mary in 1672, who told him that she wished to be venerated at a certain place in the beech woods. And the boy came across a terracotta image of the Madonna and attached it to a tree there. And with the discovery, the 7-inch Madonna of the beech was moved to a chapel, and later to its own sanctuary in the mountains in 1722. Now, on Ascension Day since 1756, an annual pilgrimage processed the image to the town and back again. And on St. Anne's Day, July 26th, the image is brought in ceremony to the site of the beech tree. And in 1975, the holy image was stolen and replaced with a replica. And that is the story of Our Lady of the Beech Tree from Castelluccio in Italy, occurring on July 26th. Today's commemoration for 365 Days with Mary. For more information on this fascinating devotion or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can go to the website 365dayswithmary.com. You can pick up the book, join the Facebook page, or
Download the free app at the iOS App Store, 365 Days with Mary, and learn each and every day what the Marian devotion of the day is. Let's take a look at the miracle of the day. We also do this every week where we talk about a miracle that's happened on this date at some point in Christian history. And so for today's date, July 26th, we've got the apparition of the guardian angel of Sister Agnes Sasagawa in Akita in Japan. And so people who know the story of Our Lady of Akita in Japan know that this is a wooden statue in the form of Our Lady of All Nations, where this nun, Sister Agnes Sasagawa, who was deaf, she received these visions or these locutions, I should say more precisely, and also she saw the tears streaming down the cheek of the statue of the Virgin Mary, which have been tested and found to be human tears. And so this guardian angel was said to give this message: "Your sufferings will end today. Carefully engrave in the depth of your heart the thought of the blood of Mary. The blood shed by Mary is a profound meaning. This precious blood was shed to ask your conversion, to ask for peace in reparation for the ingratitude and outrages against the Lord. As with devotion to the Sacred Heart, apply yourself to devotion to the most precious blood. Pray in reparation for all men. Say to your superior that the blood is shed today for the last time. Your pain also ends today. Tell them what happened today. He will understand and all immediately, and you observe his directions." So that is the reported message from the guardian angel that appeared to Sister Agnes Sasagawa as part of those visions or locutions related to the weeping statue of Our Lady of Akita in Japan in 1973. Let's take a look at the sainthood news. We always like to keep you up to date on what's coming down the pipeline with saints, and Pope Leo has been quite busy canonizing people and setting up canonizations. So last month, the Holy Father received an audience, Cardinal Marcello Semeraro, the prefect of the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints. And during this audience, the Supreme Pontiff authorized the Dicastery to promulgate a decree regarding the heroic virtues of the servant of God, Raffaele Manella, the professed cleric of the Congregation of the Missionaries of the Sacred Hearts, who's lived from 1877, born in Torre del Greco in Italy, and he died there on September 15th in 1898. And from the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints website, Raffaele Manella, who lived from 1877 to 1898, he was a professed cleric of the Congregation of the Missionaries of the Sacred Hearts. His faith in God was the cornerstone of his life, and from a young age, he went to the parish every day for Mass and in the evening to receive the Eucharistic benediction, so much so that his assiduous religious practice fostered in him the desire to become a priest. And the martyrdom was carried out by revolutionaries moved by anti-religious and anti-Christian sentiments, massacred numerous priests, religious and lay people, desecrated and pillaging churches, places of worship, and outraging sacred objects. And this odium fidei, the hatred of the faith of the guerrillas, driven by atheist propaganda, is amply demonstrated by the general violence against the church, its ministers, and many of its faithful. So that is the soon-to-be-blessed Raffaele Manella, and then with one miracle, he will be known as Saint Raffaele. Let's take a look at the might-be saint of the day. We do this every week where we look at some person on the path to sainthood whose feast day or death anniversary lines up exactly to the day's date. So for today, July 26th, we have Blessed Giuseppina Maria de Micheli from Italy. And she was born on September 11th in 1890 in Milan. And she was a sister in the Daughters of the Immaculate Conception, joining in October of 1913. And she took the name Sister Maria Perina when she made her profession in 1914. And she served in the Daughter's Mother House in Buenos Aires. And beginning on the first Friday of Lent in 1936, Sister Maria received a number of visions of Jesus and Mary that led her to promote the devotion to the Holy Face of Jesus, including the introduction of the Holy Face Medal. And she died on July 26, 1945, in Centonare, in Verbano Cusio Ossola, in Italy, of natural causes. And she was declared venerable by Pope Benedict XVI in 2007, And in 2010, by Pope Benedict XVI, she was made a blessed, and her beatification was celebrated in the Basilica of St. Mary Major in Rome and presided over by Cardinal Angelo Amato. That is Blessed Giuseppina Maria de Mescoli. One more miracle, she will be known as a saint. And she is today's Might Be Saint of the Day. When we talk about They Might Be Saints, of course, this connects to my television series and book, They Might Be Saints. The book is available from EWTNRC.com. I think it's my best one. For people who want to check out my series, you can tune into EWTN Television for it, They Might Be Saints. On Sunday, August 3rd at 1:30 p.m., They Might Be Saints, Father Michael McGivney. I examine the canonization cause of the founder of the Knights of Columbus, who was beatified in 2020 after the miraculous cure of a young boy who had fetal high drops. This cure was attributed to Father Michael McGivney, leading directly to his beatification. Find out more and check out this episode of They Might Be Saints, Sunday, August 3rd at 1:30 p.m. Central Time on EWTN Television. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Father David Uribe about Our Lady of the Snows and the Shrine in Belleville, Illinois. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. One of the things that we talk about when we talk about miracles is the impact they've had on the world. And we talk about things like sacramentals, perhaps the rosary given to St. Dominic in the year 1206, or St. Simon Stock receiving the Brown Scapular, or St. Juan Diego receiving the Tilma of Our Lady of Guadalupe, or the miraculous medal received by St. Catherine Laboure. And we also talk about the influence that they've had as far as the building of churches around the world. Believe it or not, there have been many miracles that have resulted in churches, and some very big ones at that. And I think five of the largest 12 churches in the world have sort of a miraculous backstory where, as a result of a Marian apparition or other miracle, it went on to house a church in that location. And one of the most famous cases in all of Christian history, and maybe one of the very early ones, relates to Our Lady of the Snows. There was a miracle there, perhaps a Marian apparition, or we might want to say just a miracle of snow that led to the building of St. Mary Major, one of the four papal basilicas or major basilicas found in Rome. And so we're excited today to talk with someone from the rector of the Shrine of Our Lady of the Snows in the United States, and that is Father David Uribe. And the shrine is in Belleville, Illinois. Welcome to the program today, Father David.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, this is kind of an exciting devotion. I think that many Americans don't know that, despite us having a very large shrine, your shrine here in Belleville, Illinois. And I've been to your shrine myself, being an Illinois guy myself, so we're excited today to talk about this. But I think that people should know more about this Our Lady of the Snows devotion, and it's celebrated every August 5th in Rome with a drop of white rose petals at St. Mary Major. So it's celebrated even to this day, even though it dates back to the 4th century. So let's just dial it back a little bit. What happened, according to pious tradition, with Our Lady of the Snows?
Yes, well, you know, every time our Heavenly Mother intervenes with us in some fashion, it is always around some type of event or, you know, happenings that are going about. And back in the 4th century, of course, you know, what was real prominent at the time, at least what they were getting over, was the persecution of Christians. You know, from the time of Jesus to the time of the apostles, you know, the Romans and the Jewish authorities were going after anybody who was following the footsteps of Jesus of Nazareth, you know, and trying to disprove that he was the Son of God and the Messiah. And so it was an immediate threat to the Jewish authorities, of course, and more importantly, to Rome. And Rome wanted to crush anything that was so powerful. And so, of course, you know that it led to the destruction of the temple in the year 70. You know, at least for the Romans to get that control of the Jews, and then as well. So the persecution had happened ever since then. And a lot of it was that, you know, Christians were being thrown into the underground church, you know, into the crypts, into the different places where they could gather in secret and they can gather in prayer and, you know, to celebrate, you know, the Eucharist in memory of Jesus as he asked, and of course all the blessings all the prayers and all the just the communities that could form together. And so if you imagine that that was the reality for the Christians for the first, you know, 2.5 centuries, then that, you know, was, in a sense, was a lot of prayer going up to God to be liberated from this persecution to being sought out by the Romans. So when we get up to the year of, you know, about the year 323 to 324 to 325, you know, when finally a Roman emperor finally was more of a businessman and he said, you know, this is, we've spent too much time and energy and effort and certainly finances to get rid of these followers of Jesus, these Christians as they were already known. And so, you know, they finally, as a businessman, he said, you know what, let's just do away with this. Let's just tax them and allow them to, you know, practice their faith and just freedom, religious freedom on their part. And so when he put out an edict in the empire that said that Christians are now allowed to, you know, they'll be able to pay a tax just to do what they wanted to do, and they can practice freely. Well, you know, for the Christian community, that was an answer to many, many prayers for many, many decades and of course, centuries for them to be liberated from that. So in the expression for them to, you know, really express this new faith that they're able to give glory to God and to build the church that they really wanted to, they wanted to go to the heart of the empire, and that's Rome. And so in Rome, that is where they wanted to build the great churches, especially in the great testaments of the apostles. So they knew that they could build a church for St. Peter, right where he was buried on Vatican Hill. So that's where we have the present church for the Basilica of St. Peter. Then they wanted to go to find St. Paul, where he was buried, and just outside the wall. And so there we have the great Basilica Church of St. Paul. You know, then the Lateran family had a place, you know, at time and resources that they had property as well, where they wanted to build a church as well. And so that's St. John Lateran, to be dedicated as a cathedral, as what we know as a cathedral today for the Diocese of Rome. Well, they also wanted, they came together and they said, we want to build a great church in honor of Mary. And so at that time, you know, 325, 326, they said, well, you know, Mary, the other places had physical locations within the city to build these great churches in the glory of God for all that God has done, and now that they're able to express their faith even more so, that they're able to go forth and do that. So they wanted to build this church in honor of Mary. And so what they did was, at the time, the successor of Peter just said, let's put it into prayer, you know. And so they put it into prayer. And it wasn't until about 30 years later, we believe in the year 358, that this childless couple, who were great Marian devotees, great faith in Christ and in the church, they had been praying for a long time to find this place for this church. Well, the gentleman falls asleep, and this is August the 4th of the year 358. And so he falls asleep, and in his sleep, he has a dream where Mary sends a message and says, you know, where there is snow, build my church there. So I'm sure that he got up in the morning. As everybody knows, August is the hottest month in Rome, and it is the warmest. Even the Romans, they leave the city and they go up into the mountains and they go to other places where they can, you know, experience a cooler month. So he probably got up in the morning and just said, you know, we'll look for snowfall. The next snowfall, wherever that falls, that's where we'll look. Well, he began to hear chatter on the roadside, outside the houses, in the roads, that there was a snowfall on a small hill, the Esquiline Hill there in Rome. And so he and his wife went out and they looked and they wanted to witness it, because he knew that in his dream that Mary had given that message, where there is snow, build my church. Well, as soon as they got to the spot, and sure enough, there was snow on the ground, that's where he began to tell people that he had received this message from Mary. At the same time, the successor of Peter, which is Liberius, he also showed up at the place, because he had also heard about this miracle snowfall, and he began to express the same thing as well. Mary said to me in a dream that where there is snowfall, that this is the place to build the church. And as they all came together, and as legend shows, it's Liberius who is there, who's outlining, you know, the outer walls of the church and what we know today as St. Mary Major. And so we give credit to, you know, the snowfall because of what Mary had indicated to these two faithful folks, and more importantly, to the people of God. But more importantly, that if when the churches are built, That's just the verification that God wants the graces that he that come with everything that a temple church brings about, that is always going to be a site where God gives his blessings and graces to his people. And so this is what we believe, and this is what we continue to honor in the fact that Mary, in speaking for God, is that, you know, we can certainly build these churches in which we can bring about the graces that God wants. And so we, you know, in a month that's very, very contrary to what, you know, the snowfall can bring, that this is what that means. And this is why we celebrate the miracle snowfall, even to today within the St. Mary Major Church, where we have the falling of the white rose petals from the top.
Absolutely. We've been talking today with Father David Uribe, giving this amazing story, this backstory of the building of St. Mary Major. And as he just mentioned, that every August 5th, that's celebrated in Rome, where they drop these white rose petals from the ceiling. And this is not just a devotion that stays in Rome, stays in Italy. Here in the United States, we have a national shrine of Our Lady of the Snows in Belleville, Illinois. I've been there myself. I'm an Illinois guy myself, and so I've traveled there and been to that shrine, which is a very well-developed shrine. There's just about everything that a pilgrim would want when they're visiting a shrine. Talk to us a little bit, Father David. How did this shrine come to be in Belleville, Illinois?
Sure. Yeah, we are located in Belleville, Illinois, just right outside of St. Louis, Missouri. We're just about 15 minutes east of downtown St. Louis, just crossing the Mississippi River, which makes it, you know, Illinois. And so how it started was we had a missionary priest, and, you know, we are part of the Missionary Oblates of Mary Immaculate, a religious order of priests and brothers that founded the shrine here in Belleville. And it came from this one missionary oblate who was from Germany, and he was in the seminary when the first war broke out in Europe. And so, you know, at that time when seminaries are about and the war begins to and war declared, the seminaries are emptied and everybody is enrolled into the military. And so then we got this Paul Schulte, who was in that reality. So in the First World War, one of the major advances, one of the major technology that was there was planes. And how to use planes, you know, in the effort to win a war. So he trained as a pilot for the German army and, you know, did his time during the war. When the war was over, he returned to the seminary. This time he returned to join the missionary oblates. And so when he went to the seminary, he had these hopes and dreams to go to the missions in Africa. When he was close to ordination, he got his obedience, and instead of Africa, he ended up in the Canadian Arctic, and that was his first order. So after getting ordained, he got on a boat from Europe and headed over to Montreal, landed there, was oriented about what he was going to do, and then got on his docks. You know, he says, "You're going to be a missionary to the missions that we have in the Arctic." And so he was like, "Okay, where's my vehicle?" And they said, no vehicle. You get a dog sleigh, and you get a brother who is going to accompany you. And so he did. He got on a dog sleigh, and he began to travel north from Montreal to the first mission. It took him about a month to get there, and then stayed there for about a month to do what he needed to do, and then he was on to the next mission, which took him another 3 to 4 weeks to get to. And in his mind, he's saying, "This is crazy. I'm a pilot. You know, there are a number of surplus planes that are out on the fields in Europe. I'm going to ask the Oblates if they can purchase one and have them bring it over." Sure. So that happened. So he was able to get a plane over, and he was able to fly from his the different missions. And instead of taking, you know, 3 to 4 weeks to travel, it now just took 1 to 2 days to travel through. And so he spent his time up in the Canadian. So we have a map about all the missions that he founded and that he had all along the Arctic coast, and there were a number of them. Well, he had a great devotion to Our Lady of the Snows, and how appropriate now in this reality where there's a lot of snow that, you know, he would always pray to her, and he named his mission there after Our Lady of the Snows. So what happened was that he was doing just fine, and so this is in the 30s and whatnot. Well, you know, war broke out again in 1938 in Europe, this time with the Nazi regime. And by 1941, there was a lot of suspicion with the Canadian authorities and, of course, with the Germans, you know, with the German, the Nazi regime you know, that they would come into North America. And so it just so happened that Father Schulte was at a mission one day. He was right off the coast, and on his radio, he started to get some messages in German. And he himself, as a German, you know, wanted to hear it. So he responded to one, to these messages, and it turned out to be a Nazi submarine just off the coast. Well, at the same time, the Canadian authorities also picked it up, and so they realized that there was a connection there. So the big threat was that the Nazis would come into North America either from the north or from the south, right? You know, from Mexico or from Canada. And so when the Canadian authorities approached him, they found out that this missionary oblate had mapped out all this Arctic notion with missions, and as a former soldier for the German, he became a threat to the Canadian authorities. And so they approached him. They did this research. They realized that they needed to expel him from that because he could easily be influenced. He kept insisting, "I'm a Catholic priest. I'm here to do the Lord's work. I'm here to do all these things." And so they only gave him 2 days to escape, to leave Canada. So they expelled him from Canada. He didn't know where to go. So what happened was that he just looked on the map for the oblates and realized that Belleville, Illinois was the next concentration of oblates that he could join. And so he got on a train, I believe, and ended up in Belleville. So this is of April of 1941. And that's where he came. When he came here to Belleville, the American authorities found out who he was, and as well, they were alerted by the Canadian authorities. And so when he came here, he was put under house arrest at a seminary that we had here in Belleville at the time, St. Henry Seminary. So the rector at the time decided that, you know, what he could do since he's under house arrest is just to respond to the letters for the donors and whatnot. And so there's only so many ways you can say thank you to the donors. And so he asked the superior if he could write about his stories about the missions that he had and the great devotion that he had to Our Lady of the Snows. And so the rector gave him permission. And each time he wrote a letter and put a story and put more information about Our Lady and the devotion that he had and the different mission stories, more mail would come in. He'd write another story, more mail would come in. And all of a sudden you had this donor base, you know, for the seminary who wanted to hear more stories about Our Lady of the Snows and whatnot. At the same time in the community, there was another priest, Father Edwin Guild, and he saw that this could turn into a great devotion and also a shrine. And so that's the beginnings of the shrine, was that it began through a mail campaign, just letters, but people just wanting, just hungry for the word, and more importantly, hungry for the devotion to Our Lady of the Snows. Who is this Our Lady of the Snows? And so it all happened with just this German priest, a missionary, oblate, just, you know, being at the wrong place at the wrong time, you know, coming from the wrong place because of the situation that's coming out. But then what happened was he did come here with Father Edwin. You know, the both of them decided that they would build a shrine at the seminary. And then they immediately started a novena, and the novena became very, very popular, and where thousands of people were drawn in, especially in the month of August, to come in to really celebrate this devotion that they had with Our Lady of the Snows. And the current location of the shrine right now was built, started in 1958, and it started with the grotto here, and then immediately was built for an outdoor amphitheater church, and that's what we have that was built in the 1960s. And that's with the big crowds that we had back in the days. You know, people would come on devotion, and they would come on pilgrimage to really be part of the celebration of Our Lady of the Snows, and more importantly, that Our Lady, who's always protected, especially in difficult circumstances, that Our Lady would always bring in this hope and especially the healing that people would always respond to. And so here we have this national shrine. It is the largest outdoor shrine in North America, and so we do have lots. It's about 90 acres of lots of different places, devotions. We certainly have a mass schedule. There's confessions every day. You know, we're well known here to have people to come in from lots of different places to come and receive the sacrament of reconciliation, but then as well as to be part of the programming that we have as well throughout the year.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Father David Uribe, for giving us the fascinating backstory of the Shrine of Our Lady of the Snows in Belleville, Illinois. And people can learn more about that and visit the shrine. And you have a great website or a great URL. It's snows.org, which is a great, great way to get connected to your site. And how can people find out more? What's the best way for people to visit your shrine?
Yeah, the certainly by you know, visiting our website. We've got lots of information there, snows.org, snows.org. Or you can call our main number directly, and that's 618-397-6700. And so you can call and just continue to just ask the questions. We have lots of different services. And then, you know, especially during this time of the year, we begin with our Way of Lights, which is a journey to Bethlehem. And so we turn this large acreage into lots of different, you know, we put up so many lights, over 1.5 million lights, to really represent that journey to Jerusalem. Our grotto turns into the nativity scene, and we have lots of different activities and whatnot. And that's been a tradition for over 50 years called the Shrine Way of Light. And so it's a family tradition. We welcome everybody, especially at this time of the year.
Well, this is a great time of year to go visit the Shrine of Our Lady of the Snows in Belleville, Illinois, outside St. Louis. People can find out more at snows.org. Thank you so much, Father David Uribe, for joining us on today's program.
And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to ewtn.com/radio, check out the audio archives, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Father Donald Wolf from the Shrine of Blessed Stanley Rother, and also Father David Uribe from the Shrine of Our Lady of the Snows. Check out my series, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, this week on July 26th at 5 p.m. Central Time. We'll be showing the episode of Explore Naples. I travel to Naples to probe the mystery behind San Gennaro, St. Januarius. On its feast day, the dried blood of this 3rd century bishop martyr is said to liquefy, a sign that no harm will befall the people of Naples. And I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.